Welcome to the Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 24. I'm Peter Mello from Seafever Consulting and the founder and editor of the Weekly Leader blog and podcast. And my podcasting partner is Pam Fox Rollin from IdeaShape. Hi, Pam. How's it going today?
Excellent, Peter. It is, of course, sunny in Sunnyvale. How are you doing?
Oh, good, good. It's a beautiful day here, too, as well. It's spectacular. We got a great interview this week, and we're going to change our format slightly. But before we go there, I just thought there was a couple things I'd like to just mention. First of all, we had a special edition that I put up a couple days ago. It was Leadership Lessons from a Modern Day Mutiny, and it was a story by a gentleman who contacted me a few nights ago, Captain Doug Pine. And listeners may know that I have a maritime background, and he was a listener, I guess, to my other podcast, which is Messing About in Ships, and his attorney, and he contacted me to tell this story about an experience he had aboard a ship. And I thought it would be worthwhile from a number of perspectives for the maritime listeners and Messing About, obviously, but also the leadership lessons we could take away from it. Did you get a chance to listen to that?
I was on the edge of my seat listening to that, Peter. I am not a mariner. Well, I'm a kayaker, but I don't think that really qualifies.
Sure it does.
Yeah. But that was a fascinating story. I am so glad you put that, you put that up on the podcast.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I wanted to put it up there is because I think we all encounter in our life, if we ever aspire to exercise leadership and get into a position of authority, we all encounter a situation where we prepare ourselves for our next role as a leader, and then sometimes we might get there and it's different than what we anticipated. And if there was ever a Twilight Zone scenario about that happening, I think Captain Pine's story was definitely that. So I thought there was some, decent takeaways from that front.
That was exactly it. Is starting this new role, and you know that I'm working on a book about how to start a new leadership job, and I think some of the most important preparation happens between the time you say, yeah, I'm glad to be on the short list, and the time that you actually step on deck in this case. And in most leadership jobs, people can at least get away from it to go sleep at night. When you're on a ship, you don't have that luxury. But otherwise, I think that the parallels for starting really any leadership job are striking. You don't know who's hostile to you when you start. You don't know who your allies are. And I thought it was fascinating to see him make his way to discovering who even spoke English that he could communicate with. And while it may seem like a far stretch for most leadership roles, I actually think there's great lessons there for anybody who's thinking about starting a new job.
Oftentimes you find yourself as you prepare to go into a new leadership position, and then you get in there and things might not gel the way you initially anticipate they're going to gel, and you might be even isolated. And how do you react to that? And each week we ask our leaders where they turn for their support. And I asked Captain Pine where he did, and interestingly enough, he turned to an observer aboard. And for people who listen in here who might not understand what that is in the fishing industry, is that these fishing vessels have an independent representative aboard from usually an independent nation who observes the practices aboard the vessel. And so he, that person is not part of the crew. So he bonded with that person, it seemed like, and he talked about hopefully having a lifelong friendship with that person. So just very interesting how he coped with the challenges that were presented to him.
It was a fascinating listen.
So I hope the listeners got something from it. I wanted to get up there quickly because it was a unique story, and I know they were interested in getting that story out there, so hope you enjoyed it. The other item that I just wanted to discuss real briefly is that last week we mentioned our website of the week was actually a webcast, and it was a friend of yours who did a presentation about murder boarding, and that is now up on YouTube. So we will have a link to that in the show notes for our listeners to take a look at. It's about an hour long, and I think we'll also be able to find a link to a download of a single chapter of her book that's coming out.
Great. That's Nilofer Merchant, and her book is The New How. And I thought that the chapter that they made available is really a very good read.
This week, we're going to skip our website of the week And we're also going to skip our research report of the week, but we're going to come back with those next week for sure. We just have a great interview for you, Pam. You did a super interview with someone, so you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Thank you. Bruce McNamer is the president and CEO of a nonprofit organization called TechnoServe. And they've got kind of low brand recognition, I think, because as I've talked to people about it, that kind of look and think a little bit to see if they've heard of TechnoServe. But it's a very large organization, 800 people around the world. And the focus is on supporting, nurturing, educating entrepreneurs in countries that have very few resources. And I think part of the reason that it's just becoming better known is that it's been growing enormously under Bruce's leadership over the last 4 years. And they're doing really tremendous work around the world. And Bruce is somebody that I know from business school days 15 years ago at Stanford. He also has a JD and is somebody who's so thoughtful in the conversations that we've had that I thought our listeners would really enjoy hearing from him. And I was really pleased with how candid and open he was in the conversation.
So there's a lot here. He gives us a lot of stuff to think about, leadership, and he shares a lot of himself in this interview. So let's listen to Bruce.
McNamer, thank you for joining us at Weekly Leader.
Good to be here, Pam.
Now, you and I knew each other as classmates from 15 years ago at Stanford Business School. And I remember from back then your interest in how business can serve the common good. And now you're making good on that interest as president and CEO of TechnoServe. Fill in our listeners on who you are and what you do.
Well, Pam, who I am could probably take a very long time, and even in that context be pretty boring, but let me just talk specifically about who I am professionally, at least for the time being, and it does harken back to who I am professionally. It does harken back to when you and I were first getting to know each other at business school. I had just come from the Peace Corps to business school, and even then, per conversations you and some of our classmates had at the time, thinking about how you combine the opportunity to help work with the poor and less developed countries with the kind of discipline and opportunity creation that can come with business. And so I've been fortunate enough to be able to arrive where I have at TechnoServe. And kind of the professional part of who I am is fulfilled in this organization. And TechnoServe, we're a nonprofit. We're an international development organization, and we work with entrepreneurs, with men and women in very poor countries, helping them to build businesses and thriving farms and farm cooperatives that create income and jobs and economic growth for them and for their communities and for their countries.
How did you come to be there? In particular, were there any events along your journey, Bruce, and Peace Corps may have been one of them, that laid the seeds for you that you thought it was even possible to lead this sort of organization?
Well, I think a few things. One, like many, my upbringing was certainly with my folks, was informed by, among other things, an aspiration that we and my siblings and I try to be of service in the world. And some of that was part of our faith, but part of it was just the example of my parents. I never quite got over that. Peace Corps was for me. I had actually graduated from undergraduate and got into business and worked as an investment banker. I was worked for Morgan Stanley for a number of years, but had never gotten over this idea that I had in college that, you know, what a great experience would be to go live in a foreign country and work with people there and try to be of service, but also take something selfishly from that in terms of new experience, new exposure, new sets of relationships and the like. And Peace Corps really was the perfect vehicle for that. And in my late 20s, I had kind of the stereotypically transforming experience. It was, your Peace Corps is supposed to be good for you and it's supposed to change your life. And it was both. And at the same time, I loved it. It was such a wonderful experience for me. I was in a very small little farming community in a remote part of Paraguay and spent a little over 2 years there and came from that kind of a different person and with different ideas of what I wanted to do with my life. But steeped already in the exposure I had to banking and finance and business and thinking I ought to get further training. But that at some point I wanted to return to the kind of satisfactions that I took from the work that I did with people in that community, and a notion that maybe somehow you could combine both business and that kind of work. Peace Corps certainly transformative. I think all along and throughout this, starting with family, but then sort of the families that we create in terms of the networks that we create as we go through life. It's the kind of networks and the people I've met along the way that too have helped shape that aspiration, both in kind of philosophical ways, but also in very practical ways. I had worked, I'd graduated from Stanford and then worked in management consulting and did work in the Clinton administration policy and then startup companies. But again, all along thinking, how do I combine these experiences into something that's more development-oriented? And by the very practical, I mean, I'd done a lot of work and networked with a lot of people trying to find what that ideal organization was or that ideal job or that ideal role, and really had done what I thought was my homework and talked to a lot of people, sought certain jobs, never heard of TechnoServe, and then here comes the practical. A friend of mine from, to whom I'd been very close 6 or 7 years earlier, he knew of my own aspirations, and he'd heard about a job offering here to come and run TechnoServe. He let me know about it, and then starting to explore this organization, turns out that, there was Stace Lindsay on the board of directors, whom I'd known as a kid in Billings, Montana. So now this stuff starts to come full circle, and there were a number of McKinsey directors on the board that worked there. And it was so both philosophically, the network sort of helping to shape my own aspirations, but also very practically, it turned out that, relationships I'd forged years before were really helpful in introducing me to the organization. And once I got to know a little bit more about TechnoServe and what it did seem like this perfect marriage of doing good in the world, but also using business to help to achieve that.
Neat. Oh, there are parts that I didn't know at all, Bruce, so this is fascinating for me as well. And I'm thinking about all the different things that you've done, Morgan Stanley and McKinsey and working in startups and on your way to this. At what point along the way, Bruce, might you have thought, wow, I'm developing myself as a leader. I'm leading in a certain way. And start to be thoughtful about what those leadership practices are.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's still a little odd to describe oneself as a leader, even
So I'll take you off the hook on that one. We did a podcast, a couple podcasts ago, with Marty Linsky, who has written tremendously on adaptive leadership, and he really encourages people to talk about leadership and not leaders. So when did you become conscious of your leadership?
Well, I maybe from an early age, just becoming aware that in various contexts, I was ending up as sort of in leadership positions. I mean, as a kid even. And again, an awareness, I can't remember being particularly ambitious for that. But whether it was in athletics or in, class leadership, how to account for that, it's hard to say. Maybe it's some oldest child something sticks in me. I grew up sort of accustomed to that, and never quite gotten over that. I haven't been involved in many endeavors there have been very few periods of my life where I wasn't doing something that you might somehow equate with leadership, whether that was, again, as a kid or in sports growing up or in class stuff or as an undergrad in various quasi-student government things or in nonprofits, either in board positions or the like, or in startups. And I think sometimes those positions beget the future position. And in fact, I think there's a whole other very interesting conversation which you could have about how kind of being lucky early kind of begets kind of more of the same later on. Lucky enough to kind of end up in one institution, and that kind of, I won't even say for better or for worse, generally for better brands you for the next institution, and that cumulatively brand you for the next institution, and maybe that's true of some, tumbling up in leadership, too.
And one of the things that I hope that we'll get to is you're running an organization that, for many people, I'm imagining, is the first time somebody's branded them as a leader. They are... and maybe they've had a small shop or they've had some leadership role in their village or in a small-scale occupation, and your organization says, if you've got the drive, the willingness, the openness, we're ready to help you take it big.
Well, that's right. And in just a couple of thoughts on that, I think that is almost fundamentally what we do. I mean, we may be working with an entrepreneur on getting the business plan right, the business model right, thinking about strategy, thinking about technical aspects of their business, finance, operational issues. But ultimately what we're really training them for is, yes, there's a set of tools there, but it's the bringing them all together and most critically bringing the people that work with them to getting them to coalesce around a shared vision, a shared way of working together, kind of a common purpose, is the most important thing we do. And it runs through all these elements of that, but ultimately it is about leadership. You're right. As I think about, even seminal kind of leadership experiences for me, even reflecting back to your earlier question, I would point to just a couple. One was actually in the Peace Corps for me, working in a very small village, again, as I described. Somewhere into my tenure there, it was started with kind of general basic public health and sanitation, and then we sort of took on more things as a community. But probably a year into my tenure there, so much of what I did there was community organization. It was getting people to work together. And in a context in which, after 35 years of oppressive dictatorship in Paraguay, that had ended the year before, and for the first time people could self-organize and work together without being, brought to the attention of the government. And so they themselves were starting to learn about leadership. And I remember trying to organize a commission there to help build what we ended up being a high school in the village. And first being approached by this guy, Eleuterio Duarte, they call him Leu. But Leu at that point was about 45 years old. He'd been a farmer all his life. He had 9 kids. He was really focused on his family and his extended family, but hadn't really been involved in the community because of the kind of politics. But he was very keenly interested in the well-being of both of his family and community, and now he had an opportunity to get involved. And Leu and I are very good friends to this day, but Leu as a leader in this remote corner of Paraguay is unlike most leaders I've ever seen in terms of his just natural instincts around galvanizing people, giving them an example of what it means to do something with energy, with great energy and with great integrity, and being able to motivate people to follow him. And I have seen very few people like Leu in my life, and I was reminded even then of, you know, is it Thomas Gray? There's a poem in there somewhere, Elegy in a Country Churchyard, about unsung Miltons. And, you know, this is Leu, you know, I've heard of Leu, and now you've heard of Leu, but no one's heard of Leu, and there he is, and there are leaders everywhere. And one of the things that TechnoServe does every day is to help them identify themselves as such and give them some tools and some opportunities to put that leadership to work. And that was certainly true of, you know, my own interaction with Leu in that very small village. So that to me was a really, really telling thing. I had the opportunity to, very good luck actually, to spend a year as something called the White House Fellow. And the White House Fellowship was started in the Johnson administration as a way to help people at a certain, probably kind of mid-30s who had some diverse and interesting experiences to get a real close, up-close exposure to leadership in government, particularly in the executive branch of the government. And it's a very well-structured program that, you know, puts people into jobs at various places in the administration. I worked at the National Economic Council at the White House. And thereby get that exposure with, you know, more than full-time work, but also a series of opportunities to interact with leaders, to talk about leadership. And in the context of a program like that, which is so very consciously about leadership, it was just such a remarkable exposure to a breadth of leadership styles and motivations and even opportunities. And one of the better experiences of my own life, and a very formative experience for me too, certainly in terms of, you know, practically speaking, in terms of learning kind of a little bit at least about working in government, which was a new experience for me, about policy, about how things work in Washington, but kind of more than that, just this exposure to leadership and to thinking consciously about leadership and being exposed to different leadership styles. So that a real kind of, for me, formative experience around leadership. And then certainly there's been a lot of kind of on-the-job training for me around leadership, and I have a long way to go. That's nowhere more true than here at TechnoServe, which has been an education in leadership and a great one.
So how do you get feedback about yourself as a leader? And in it strikes me that when you're in a program like White House Fellows, it comes more naturally when you're explicitly in a leadership development program to ask people for feedback and input about oneself. But in working with a variety of chief executives of organizations in different sectors, they often find it really difficult to get real information on what's the impact of how they're leading. And I just recorded something this morning about blind spots, but to see, you know, for somebody to say, hey, Bruce, let's talk, because I think there's something you persistently miss.
Yeah.
How do you put that in place for yourself?
Well, a few things. One, there are more and less obvious ways to do that. I think it is the case that oftentimes if you ask for feedback, you may not get honest feedback just by virtue of kind of the role you play. I think it's often the case that if you do ask for feedback, careful what you wish for, because you actually may get honest feedback. I think there is an element, kind of a process element, to getting the right kind of feedback, and that is to get somebody else to get it for you in a kind of formalized way. And I know I've done that at various junctures here at TechnoServe, kind of blind, I guess it's not, well, it is a little bit of 360 review. At first, I was sort of seeking that from the folks that I work with, but at certain points, we're reaching out to the board of directors, too, and trying to get some feedback there. And actually, curiously, in that instance, that's driven by the board of directors as much as by me. And I think there's actually more that I could do here. I've probably gone through that exercise two or three times, but I would actually like to do that more formally and more often. And I think there's a lot of value in that, but that's not the whole story either. I think it's true that if you ask for feedback, you're also offering to do something with it. And that's kind of very often the missing piece of it. Because in a kind of, let's call this is an evaluation, right? It's sort of your leadership style, but if you're on the sort of giving end of evaluation, particularly in an organization where people who report to you, you know, you're having this dialogue, but then at the end of it, there's some, well, here's what we're going to do next, and here's the areas we're going to work on. And just thinking now about the ways I've sought feedback, I think I've sort of missed part of that because I've sought the feedback, and that was kind of the last anybody heard about it. In other words, I wasn't reflecting back to the people in this circle around me. Here's what I heard. Here's maybe what I ought to do about it, and here's my commitment. I ought to do more of that.
Okay.
It's I'm not saying it's easy to hear feedback all the time. Sometimes it's not, but you can kind of keep it to yourself. And particularly if you happen to be in charge, it's thanks for your feedback. But no kind of ongoing commitment to do anything thereafter. So that's
powerful for people in your organization to see you take feedback, do something with it, and have that commitment and accountability.
Right. Yeah. I think it would be powerful.
I'm curious, you mentioned your board. What do you find different about leading in a nonprofit, even one that's focused on business but still has a nonprofit form, versus leading in a for-profit?
I think it is as complex, if not more complex, because of the very legitimate interests of such a diverse set of stakeholders, and because of the multiple bottom lines, not just in terms of our impact, but in terms of what people want when they come to a place like this, what they expect from their involvement. In a corporate context, you may have many companies, increasingly you do, talking about having multiple stakeholders, but ultimately it's the shareholder. And the bottom line is your returns, your financial returns. And that's something you can manage too, and it's a stakeholder group you can prioritize around. But in a not-for-profit context, that's not quite so clear. And so you have different stakeholders with serious interests, and some are your employees, some are the people you serve, some are your board members, certainly your donors.
Yeah.
And at times, their interests conflict. And managing in that is difficult. Similarly, I think it's too simple to say that in the private sector it's about your paycheck, because people come to work in private companies for all kinds of reasons. But that's sure an important one. And I think in many of nonprofits, people have taken a substantial pay cut to come work or could be making a lot more elsewhere. And it's sure true at TechnoServe. A lot of people in this organization could be making a lot more money elsewhere in the private sector, but they've made a choice, and it's not just about the paycheck, but it's about what they think they're achieving vis-a-vis our mission, and how effective are they being, and then the things that and how fulfilled are they, and do they feel like there are opportunities for them to continue to learn in environments that are more resource constrained. So there are a whole bunch of things that go into dealing with managing people in that context, which may not apply quite so strongly in private companies. Now, I'd also say that in, you know, just as nonprofit statement, they vary. They come in all shapes and sizes, sort of private companies or private sector companies. Sometimes the distinction between not-for-profit and for-profit aren't really that apparent at all. And in fact, I often got the question, particularly in my first 1 or 2 years here, what's it like working in a nonprofit? And I, you know, it's what I had to answer sometimes, I'm not quite sure. I know what it's like to work at TechnoServe. I know in many instances it's, in terms of its focus on impact and it's the way we were managed and the like, it did feel pretty private sector-like. And yet there are these differences I spoke of. So I think it is a little bit hard to say, here's once and for all the ways that nonprofits are from private sector companies.
So as you've been navigating these complexities of different stakeholders wanting different things and having multiple bottom lines, what have you been learning about yourself as a leader in this part of your career?
Mm-hmm. Well, you and I may have talked about this before, but I think it's so important to be, to the extent possible, really aware of how you as a person, with your likes and dislikes and your securities and your insecurities and your kind of way of thinking about being in the world, this is sort of just state the obvious, but we need to remind ourselves, so impact how you manage and how you lead, and to be really, I'm increasingly aware of that. Sometimes the two shouldn't really go together. Or, you know, being aware of those, you know, those traits in my own personality, which I need to perhaps moderate as a leader or be very aware of as a leader. I'm a very pleasing person. I don't particularly like confrontation in the world. I like people a lot. I want people to feel good. Those are generally, they work pretty well for me in the world. Actually, they work pretty well in a corporate setting, too. However, sometimes they don't. And I think understanding where they don't and understanding those proclivities and tendencies and avoiding an over-reliance on those where they're maybe not appropriate as a manager or a leader is really important. And it starts with awareness, but then it also extends to a discipline to behave in an alternative manner. Discipline is from tools and the ability to. I think maybe the more you do it and the more you're aware, the better you're able to do that. But I think that's really important. I think, too, and it's consistent with that, and I think you and I have talked about this, I think there is something, it just depends on the person, but I'm wary of certain, what I'm describing as being kind of sterility in management and not bringing a human element to it, but I think not taking things personally is so real, so very important. I think I may have described once in a conversation with you before this, I think, pretty important lesson I took from reading about Abraham Lincoln. This was I know Team of Rivals talks about, by Doris Kearns Goodwin, talks about Lincoln and the fact that he surrounded himself in his first cabinet with people who despised him and ran against him and had ambitions, political ambitions against him. Gore Vidal actually wrote historical fiction about this Lincoln and treated the same thing. And he described, and I believe it's probably is based on fact, how Lincoln in this context, after a particularly brutal cabinet meeting where he'd basically been savaged and insulted by his members of his own cabinet, would come back and sit down and write out the most scathing letters to each of them, really letting them know how he felt in cutting terms, and then would fold up those letters and put them in a drawer and write like a quick and clever one-liner to each of them, and just kind of passing it off. In other words, not falling back on, you know, anger or personalizing it, but just thinking more actually coldly about this. And I've thought of that often. In that inevitable, and this is so email so facilitates that, you know, you get this communication from somebody and my first instinct very often is just flame back and lash out, and boy, can I do it effectively, and it'll be so cutting, and it'll put them in their place. And I've actually written on a lot of those emails, fewer over the years, mercifully, but and then not sent them. And based on that example of, you know, that kind of Lincoln example, and put them into draft, and then kind of taken a deep breath, and then written a short kind of one-liner. so much more effective. I think, you know, and again, this be a little aware of being too sterile and not human as a manager, and be a little, I think I mean, you know, we probably ought to be aware of, you know, management devoid of emotion and human empathy and the like. But I think for someone, maybe for someone like me, that's probably the least of my challenges. I mean, right. I'm always going to be human in this. I'm fatally human. but leaving that aside and having the, I guess, self-knowledge and the, I guess, wisdom or learning something in this process, to just take the proverbial deep breath and not to personalize things, but to do the right things for the organization. It's not about you. It's about the organization. It's about the mission. And I think you can get better, particularly the longer you're in these things. And I think some of that is just a function of insecurity, too. I think it's easier to react in a very kind of personalized way if maybe there's an element of truth to what you're hearing or to what's coming at you. And it creates fear and preys on insecurities. And I think the longer you do these things, the more confidence you get, the more competence, frankly, the less that's an issue. Now, and it's not to, well, it's to ramble a little more. I think the flip side of the whole increasing confidence or competence thing to be wary of is complacence and kind of losing the sense of urgency or wonder that inevitably you have early in your tenure in certain leadership positions.
I appreciate on multiple levels what you just said, and you do lead in a very human, connective way, was my experience of you early in your career, and to see that you're still in that place and you still question and you're self-aware and you... we've all had increasing confidence, you know, over 15 years of leadership, but that you're still thinking, okay, what might I be missing? What's the other side of this? It's really nice to hear, Bruce.
Well, thanks, man. Maybe I'm just a slow learner.
Well, and this may be, you know, I'm finding it fascinating. So earlier in the week, I had the opportunity to talk with Fran Meyer, who's a GSB alum and CEO of Trustee, and she quoted the exact same book.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Is that right? That's so great.
Same, in somewhat similar reason, she didn't talk about the letters, but how strategic and pragmatic Lincoln was in working with his senior team.
Right.
So there's a few questions that we like to ask all the weekly leaders that we interview, and one is about how to manage work life. How do you keep your batteries charged?
Well, in a very real sense, I think so many of us, except me, have to balance a lot more. This way, my friends, my family, people I know in leadership positions are balancing, you know, their work and their passions in that regard with personal interests and family. I'm not faced with that yet. I'm 46 years old, and I'm not married. I don't have a family. I would still hope to do that at some point, but I'll just tell you very practically, the choices I have to make in kind of work-life balance are not facing these painful trade-offs. And that more than anything helps to inform my work-life balance. And, you know, the decisions I make with respect to working more or less affect me, and not my kids, and not my spouse. And I genuinely hope to be faced with that conundrum at some point, but I'm not. And so, you know, I travel a lot, and I like that. And it doesn't have the kind of flip side that is you know, missing home and family and not being there for them. So I think that more than anything helps me to balance, but I'm not really balancing. But that's not to say I work all the time. I think I work pretty hard, but I have the luxury of having great colleagues who are very competent people and who work really hard too, and they themselves balance. They really balance.
How do you help
they're able
balance
to do that?
As a leader who, you know, wants a lot from your team, mm-hmm. how do you help it be sustainable for them?
Really difficult. It's really difficult because I think it is easy to talk about all of us, you know, want to respect each other's work-life balance, and I think, you know, there's a way to do the right things too. And some of it just extends to I'm not calling you on the weekend. Some respect for it's Friday, I'm not going to come in and say I need this Monday. And for a certain style around that, and for a certain understanding of what people deal with, those are all important. But, you know, the more fundamental drivers of how difficult it is for people in organizations to work around life-work balance is just the sheer amount of work. And we kind of bring it on ourselves by virtue of our aspirations and by virtue of decisions we've made about the organization to, in this instance, really try to aggressively, over the last 5 years, grow this organization and, you know, really expand our impact in the countries in which we work. And I think it's been great for the organization. I think we've really been able to do that and in ways that are really important for, frankly, for people's lives in the places we work, and to do it at a scale we've never been able to do it, but it comes with trade-offs. And I think a lot of times those trade-offs are borne by the people who work here. And part of it is that's a trade-off I actually don't have to make so much because these are people with families.
One of the things
they do make it.
One of the things that I've been struck with, Bruce, in doing just a little bit of international development work, there's an organization called Global Women's Leadership Network, and I know you're familiar with it, to help women leaders from around the world to develop and connect up and not feel isolated. And for many of them, it's, you know, very poignant. They have lost their, you know, been shunned by families because they have dared to lead in, you know, different communities. And I would guess that learning about and respecting and navigating those cultural differences is really important in what you do.
Extremely, yep. And how do you, and even at least as important is, what can you do about it? I mean, and because I think some of those attitudes, particularly for women in our organization, they face the demands that we've already been talking about, but they also face them in a cultural context, which makes it even more difficult. In a cultural context where for women to be challenged professionally and to take on professional challenges, like we ask of people who come to tech serve, is a hard sell. And it's not nearly so well understood as it might be here. Hard, very hard. And it's, you know, how do we affect cultural change? Well, I don't think we can. Except by providing, you know, the people who work for us just opportunities to develop their own sort of sets of professional leadership skills and try to be supportive as I deal with a lot. More than I might deal with here.
Couple last questions, because Bruce, this is amazing, and if people would listen to 5-hour podcasts, I would stay and interview you for 5 hours. But one of the questions we ask is if you could lunch with a historical or contemporary leader, who would you want to talk with, and what would you want to talk about?
Well, we talked about Lincoln, right?
Yep.
I mean, and that. Well, I'm really interested in how leaders make decisions, and particularly leaders who don't have time to make decisions, I mean, who are so beset. I mean, President Obama, right, makes 20 really important decisions every day. how, you never have enough information. You can never get the full context. So how do you set up sort of structure? Well, take the President Obama. How do you set up structures and organizations and deal with people such that you're given the right information or enough of the right information to make a pretty good decision? And then how do you make that, and then how do you move on? So I'm just very interested in how leaders generally do that, particularly presidents. I don't know how they – Lincoln, I just think, would have been so fast – for some of the reasons we've described. You know, at the end of the day, he made some of the hardest decisions any U.S. president has ever made. And I think sometimes, you know, the best decision makers – they're not burdened with, you know, a deep capacity for introspection or for self-doubt or for, you know, really grappling. They make decisions, they move on. But I think it would just be fascinating to talk to somebody about Lincoln, because I think he was. I think he was a deeply introspective person, you know, with a sort of tragic sensibility, who could see shades of gray, you know, and who could really, you know, take things to heart. And yet was able to make decisions and not be, you know, hampered in that by, you know, this deeper sense of what was, you know, what was implied by the decisions that he made. Just must have been such an interesting fella. But so many, I mean, and you know, but again, so Lincoln or the president or, you know, our latest Nobel laureate, you know, just to see how they actually structure this. And then do it, and do it confidently. But it's curious. I mean, some of that curiosity is much about process as it is about, you know, in that kind of presidential context. How do you set up a process that gets you the two-page memo that so succinctly captures the pros and cons of the hard decisions? Because those are the decisions you make.
That's, I have to say, one of the most fascinating things to me about being an executive coach and working with your teams is to watch the processes. And I'm always struck by leaders who are conscious of that, because I think it's easy to not pay attention to the process by which the information has flown to you
right. And
your consultations and all of that.
Yeah. So, right, and then there you are making a decision that, based on a flawed process or one that people can manipulate, or, and you know, maybe that's fine, because at the end of the day, the most important thing is somebody makes a decision somewhere. And there's no perfect process, but how do you get as close as possible?
So what's one piece of advice you would share with aspiring leaders?
I think the first thing would be don't take advice from me. But
Well, the irony is people are taking advice from you, Bruce, all around the world. So what are you telling them?
You know, but for aspiring leaders, I think, and I've seen how leaders inspiring leaders do this, and I didn't do enough of it, and don't do enough of it. Seek mentors, and be aggressive about it, and don't be shy about it, and don't feel like, you know, you have to be bringing your mentors a whole bunch of content and insights yourself. I think it's an instinct as a young person to say, what do I have to share with this person, when in fact, would-be mentors are just happy to be asked and flattered to be asked and take a genuine interest in the development of younger people. And all you need to do is show up and ask for it, and it can be so helpful. And I myself was and am burdened by this notion that, you know, what's in it for them? Well, and what can I sort of do for them? Well, I think you do for them by being interested. And I think just having that network of people can be so useful later in life. So I would start there.
Bruce, this has been a tremendous opportunity to talk with you, and I have learned so much, and I know our listeners will.
So that was Bruce McNamer, the CEO of TechnoServe, and there was so much in that interview that, what do you want to start, Pam?
Well, I want to start with what he said about being fatally human. And I really appreciated that he said, I'm weary of sterility and management and balancing that with not taking things personally. I think leadership can get to be formulaic. And we always talk about the value of studying leadership. But if it's applied as sort of a set of rules instead of being advised by what you learn as a leader, then you can wind up leading in a style that is disengaging and doesn't seem authentic. And what I have appreciated about Bruce is he's very conscious of that, and at the same time is not somebody who wants it to be about him. So he's right there in the middle of that ambiguity of how do I lead as a person without taking things personally or making it about me.
Yeah, he's a great storyteller, isn't he? I mean, he's a friend of yours, so obviously you've heard him tell a few stories, I'm sure. But to me, he was just so engaging throughout the whole interview, intertwining leadership stories. And we talk a lot about that in the past podcasts, about how people are able to, how successfully leaders are able to use stories. And I think he did a fantastic job with that, at least with me. It really engaged me. And I was also, I love the idea, I believe that leadership is most often, the foundation of it is experience. And I liked when you asked him about a point in his life that really kind of marked his leadership. You know, he said, look, you know, I've always, as long as I can remember, I've been leading. And I believe in also in that accumulative nature of leadership, that these experiences continue to build themselves over time. And that's how you really develop your leadership. So I really enjoyed that part of his interview.
I really also liked how he talked about feedback and the challenge of getting it, but also be careful what you wish for. And the importance of setting up some processes so that you get systematic feedback. And then he offered something that I think is super important, is that if you're asking for feedback, you're also volunteering to do something with it.
Right.
And I love how he put it. He said, here's what I heard. Here's what I ought to do about it. Here's my commitment. And then he said, I ought to do more of that.
Yeah.
If, you know, we believe that reflection on one's own leadership contributes to the quality of that leadership, I think Bruce might be a really tremendous example of being reflective about oneself as a leader.
Yes. And Abe Lincoln came up again in this one. And I absolutely love, and I try to subscribe to this, his concept of, you know, vent, write your long note, put it in the bottom drawer, and then take it out later and just do a one-liner. I think that is great advice to anybody, especially when you're confronting a situation that you might have a difference of opinion on. And then my final takeaway on it is really I loved his advice. You know, seek out mentors and be more aggressive about it than you might naturally be. You might think you need to be. You know, I believe also that, you know, if you ask people, they're there to help. And I think that's what he was basically saying. So seek out mentors, seek out people you can learn from, and don't be shy about it.
Also mentioned that off the tape, I asked him about social media, because that's something we usually talk with our weekly leaders about. And they're just getting into it. He's seen the need for it. He's brought on some folks, or charged some folks who are more into it themselves than their sort of general staff population, to form an initiative around social media. But interestingly, they're starting first with communications among themselves, because the challenge of having conversations across an 800-person organization in dozens of countries is daunting, and he thinks that there are some ways that social media could really support them in internal communications.
Yeah, well, that's what we heard in our first two episodes from Peter Aceto, and that's his initial focus on social media at ING Direct was to use it internally. So maybe Bruce might want to give that that episode a listen and give Peter a call. So, do you have any closing thoughts about the interview with Bruce or this week's podcast in general?
Well, just, I'm really appreciative of the folks who come to this podcast who are straight up about the challenges of it and also the joys. And that was one of the things that came through about Bruce and how he leads, is that he is getting to live what he's always wanted to live and make the contributions he's always wanted to make through his work with this organization. And I hope that when people hear about all the challenges of leadership, that they also appreciate the satisfaction of being able to make a difference, not always on a scale as big as Bruce, but at some point those opportunities are available too.
That's right. That's what leadership is all about. The leadership moment, take advantage of it. So Pam, it was a great chatting this week, and I look forward to catching up with you next week.
Super.
We look forward to you joining us in the Leadership Conversation. We've given you lots of ways to do that. So head on over to the website, which is weeklyleader.net, and find the podcast post and tell us what you thought about this episode or prior episodes or what you'd like to hear in the future. We are very fortunate to have a talented team of bloggers who are passionate about the topic of leadership, and they'd love for you to join them in the Leadership Conversation. So check out the website and join the conversation there. We are on Twitter. Weekly Leader is at Weekly Leader. Pam is at PamFR, and I'm at Peter Mello. That's PeterMello. And all of our other contributors are also on Twitter, and their IDs will be in the show notes. We use iTunes to distribute this podcast, and it really helps when we get reviews and recommendations over there. So if you've done it, we thank you very much. If you haven't, we'd appreciate it if you'd give it a shot. It doesn't take too long, and it helps us get more listeners. We always use PodSafe music, and this week, in honor of Bruce McNamer's interview, he leads TechnoServe. Their mission over there is to develop leaders internationally, and it's a nonprofit organization. We sought out some world music and found Angelique Kidjo, who was initially from the African country of Benin, left there at a very young age, and pursued her musical career in Paris, and currently resides in New York City. The song we used on either side of Bruce's interview was Salala, she did with Peter Gabriel. And the song we're going to close out with is one she did with Joss Stone, and it's called Gimme Shelter. So we thank you very much for investing your very valuable time with us, and we look forward to being with you again next week.